Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. The month of March has been the annual observance of Women's History, or more aptly, Her Story Month. Only recently have women's claims to their vital role in the human story been regarded seriously, and in American historiography, it is still difficult to entertain other than a male Caucasian cosmology, which is tokenly acknowledged in the quasi-separatist Black History Month each February. In the rationale that Black history represents a significant minority, separate but still unequal in American history, and has only become a national consideration at the insistence of Black advocation for it for nearly a century, Women's History Month manifests a minority only elusively, as women are actually half or more of humanity. The insinuation of women as a second-class minority group is a misanthropic weasel wording that implies gender-biased inferiority of subjective subservience and servility that is intolerable, inappropriate, and impractical. Historically, male dominance has led to a dead end of probable speciesside from nuclear holocaust and or climate-caused extinction. Each and both literally man-made. Although humanity is a single species, its genders have significantly separate stories. Fundamentally, one is of birth, nurturing, and life. The other is the predator-raptor gender, a clash of persuasion and connection versus force and supremacy, obviously in the broadest diagnoses. That must not ignore individual personal disposition intrinsic to persons of either sex. The male gender is particularly suffused with misogyny, as well as misanthropy in general, and as a result is the major danger to the survival of the anthropophagic species, and also to life itself on Gaia. Quite possibly the first species perpetrated extinction in terrestrial history. The social, political, and personal equality of women, consequentially, transcends every other pressing equity because it is the most basic correction for humanity to make, as well as the most potent force to successfully fulfill virtually everything else that needs to be done if our species is to survive. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg was recently quoted as saying that although the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which gave birthright citizenship to everyone born in the U.S. or has been naturalized as citizens, and essentially gave all citizens equal protection under the law, protected women, quote, almost as far as would an Equal Rights Amendment. An ERA would have intrinsic value. I would like to be able to take out my pocket constitution and say that the equal citizenship stature of men and women is a fundamental tenet of our society, like free speech, Justice Ginsburg said. Abortion is a special reason for an Equal Rights Amendment to the Constitution, essentially because the 1973 Supreme Court decision legalizing it, Roe versus Wade, is always under threat and continually undermined by right-wing politicians and religious groups, most of them men, but also by quite a few latter-day Phyllis Schlafly clones, such as two Trumpian United Nations negotiators who are attempting to block international agreements on global women's rights, specifically abortion and reproductive health rights, which include universal sex education. American women are not full citizens of the USA if they are denied the right to make elemental decisions about abortion and their bodies in general. The hypocrisy is that women have had to make these decisions for thousands of years. Women have been responsible for birth control or forced to be the instruments of euthanasia in regards to unwanted children in the vacuum left by irresponsible men. Abortion at least allows a woman to dispose of an unwanted fetus before it is born. For some reason, men who abdicate their responsibility for birth control yet believe they should control a woman's birth options. This form of reverse birth control has less to do with concern for the unborn fetus than it does retaining supremacy over women who are not respected as free and equal citizens, especially about abortion. Yet, as with slavery a century and a half ago, abortion causes furious arguments and is such an emotional issue that a civil war of sorts is in continual stages of eruption. The Supreme Court has been a major battleground, but nothing has been settled, which has enraged both sides, so-called pro-life and pro-choice. For all the controversy, abortion is a survival mechanism that attempts, consciously or subliminally, to alleviate the ever-increasing ravage of Earth by an overabundant species that seldom practices conscientious or successful birth control. In the bad old days, children were abandoned or slaughtered when a population overran its resources. It was quite often then, and is once again now, that women are left to make the necessary decisions, too often against terrific and unequal dispute, and just as often despised for taking responsibility away from the irresponsible. Some of the worst traits of male dominance are ruthlessly displayed against women. Men brutalize women. They assault, batter, and murder women. The most vulnerable victims of violence and murder are women. Women are regularly assaulted for purposes of rape and frequently die in the course of it. Men joke about rape. They call it assault with a friendly weapon. That gives men who think that way the sense they can use their friendly weapon on any woman at any time or place, whether she likes it or not. The assumption is that women, all women, are subservient to men. Men who hate women, who are psychopathic in their contempt for women, promote the same malevolent, or you might say malevolent, opinion. These men make war on women. They use their muscle and implicit power to dominate women absolutely and crush them when they resist or rebel. They beat up their wives and girlfriends habitually, daughters also, and beat them again if they complain or seek help, and often, eventually, beat them to death. Women who have fought back have been ostracized, imprisoned, and executed. Thousands of women, perhaps even millions, were burned to death as witches during medieval times and afterward, as late as in the 17th century New England. 19th century suffragists were often attacked and jailed, and although modern feminists have suffered less than their foresisters, more verbal abuse and ridicule than physical assault, in the United States at least, the problem of violent attacks by men against women is no less serious than it has ever been. Organizations to protect women from assault and battery have sprung up all over the United States, inspired not by official concern, but by battered women themselves. The fear of male violence is bred into women's very souls, Margaret Frimuth, former director of the Clatsop County Women's Crisis Service, has written. It is the fear of being harassed, beaten, threatened, and kidnapped, of being raped, of being tortured and threatened as less than human, and then killed at the hands of male power. And that was Margaret Frimuth. The Violence Against Women Act that was passed in 1994 originally allowed women to sue their attackers, but the Supreme Court struck that down as part of the law. That apparently would change with an Equal Rights Amendment to the Constitution. Yet, as Susan Chira wrote in the New York Times, what the ERA would change and what it would not is both bitterly contested and hypothetical, particularly in the areas of violence against women, sexual harassment, and equal pay. And that was Susan Chira. Emboldened by passage of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the vote a century ago. Alice Paul introduced the Equal Rights Amendment at a National Women's Party convention in 1921, which she asserted was the next women's rights issue. In 1923, the NWP introduced its Equal Rights Amendment to Congress, which stated, "Men and women shall have equal rights throughout the United States and every place subject to its jurisdiction," quote unquote. Many women's groups and labor activists opposed the bill because it eliminated what they claimed were hard-won protective legislation for women workers. Indeed, the Supreme Court invalidated a minimum wage law essentially because it did not give men and women equal rights. The ERA was reintroduced 20 years later into the House of Representatives by Congresswoman Hattie Caraway in 1943. The ERA was changed to read, "Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex," quote unquote, which remains as its current wording. Failing to pass the House, women in several states set up ERA committees that lobbied state legislatures to pressure Congress, which might have been stymied by World War II priorities, despite the war work and generally intended non-combat war service by millions of American women. After Pearl Harbor, the government urged industry to tap into woman power, and that's a quote, for the intense labor effort necessary to win the war. The Senate voted on the ERA for the first time in more than 20 years in 1947. The count of 38 for and 35 against was far short of the two-thirds majority needed. In 1967, the National Organization for Women, NOW, made as one of eight demands included in NOW's Bill of Rights, immediate passage of the Equal Rights Amendment. Finally, in 1970, the House approved the ERA, 350-15, after only an hour debate following Representative Martha Griffiths' successful effort to get it out of the Judiciary Committee. But the Senate refused to vote on the ERA until 1972, following intense lobbying by women's groups, especially NOW. The measure was approved 84-8. By the end of the year, 22 states, led by Hawaii, ratified the amendment. In addition, six states, Colorado, Hawaii, New Mexico, Texas, Washington, and Maryland, added equal rights amendments to their state constitutions, preceded by Pennsylvania the year before. However, by 1978, Congress was urged to extend the ratification deadline beyond March 1979 because a shortfall of 35 out of a required 38 states had ratified the ERA. 7 years were requested, but Congress extended the deadline limit only 4 years to June 30, 1982. Equal rights amendment supporters not only organized campaigns to pass ERA in the states, but also fought against campaigns to rescind it. In 1979, NOW and other pro-ERA groups managed to head off attempts to revoke ERA ratification in 13 states, but were unable to gain any new states than the 35 states that had already ratified the ERA. The necessary three states never ratified the Equal Rights Amendment by the June 1982 deadline, although polls showed that 63% of the American public supported it, with only 32 opposed, two-thirds for and two-thirds against. 15 states rejected the ERA, and four others attempted to rescind their support, but the move was thought to be unconstitutional. Among the main arguments used to defeat the ERA were the specter of women being drafted into the armed forces and forced to serve in combat, the potential loss of alimony and child custody preference in divorce cases, and the possibility that tax money would have to be used for abortions. Anti-feminists also put forth absurd but highly symbolic scenarios, such as unisex toilets. Right-wing women, such as Phyllis Schlafly and her Eagle Forum, dedicated to, quote, family values and law and order, considerably upset the equal rights campaign. Yet the same month as ERA's failure to be ratified by its 1982 deadline, 51 U.S. senators and 201 representatives co-sponsored the ERA in both houses of Congress. That attempt also failed. The ERA has been pronounced dead and sent to the grave more than once since Alice Paul wrote the original amendment 98 years ago in 1921. It took 7 decades for women to gain the vote in the USA, so it should be no surprise that the Equal Rights Amendment will not stay dead. In fact, the ERA dynamo is being restarted, perhaps in recognition of the centennial of the 19th Amendment this year. Efforts are being made to repeal or overrule the 1982 deadline for the ERA ratification, and 2 states have revived the process, Nevada in 2017, followed by Illinois last year in 2018. Virginia came close to being the 38th and final state to endorse this possible act of resurrection this past January when the state Senate voted its approval, but the state House killed its progress. Another stickler is that 5 states have since rescinded their earlier ratifications, which would most likely start a fierce legal squabble over the fact that the Constitution speaks only to a state's power to ratify an amendment and nothing about reversing its initial approval. A national referendum would probably make the ERA law of the land within only a few months. Instead, whenever it is revived again, this year or next or the one after that, under the current process of constitutional amending, it must again traverse the same convoluted maze through the states, which even the most optimistic adherents believe it will take years. Kathy Hochul, Lieutenant Governor of New York State, says, "The new era's ERA will ensure constitutional equality on the basis of sex. But this is not a binary issue. We will approach this through the intersectional lens of gender, sex, class, race, orientation, and identity. Lack of access to affordable child care, beyond reasonable costs for in vitro fertilization, health care disparities, biases in the workplace and in schools. All of these are perpetuated in existing institutions and affect all marginalized groups. We see it and feel it every single day. I believe anyone who questions the relevancy of the ERA in the 21st century is woefully out of touch." And that was Kathy Hochul, who, Lieutenant Governor of New York State. And Amelia Harnish, writer and editor of Refinery 29, on March 19th, speaking about the renewed effort to revive the ERA, "If you think the Equal Rights Amendment died in the 1970s, do we have a story for you? It's alive, and all we need is one more state before a feminist dream becomes actual American law." In retrospect, this past Monday, March 25th, was the 108th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in New York City that killed 146 garment workers, 123 women, and 23 men who died from the fire, smoke inhalation from falling or jumping to their deaths from the burning building. Most of the victims were recent Italian and Jewish immigrant women aged 14 to 23. A reporter at the scene said, "I learned a new sound that day, a sound more horrible than description can picture, the thud of a speeding, living body on a stone sidewalk." 90 years later, on 9/11/2001, that same sound resounded on New York City sidewalks and streets. Exits at the shirtwaist factory were locked, which was against the law, though the owners were acquitted following an investigation that was as corrupt as it was scandalous. Fire ladders were unable to reach the top floors, so the mostly young women and male victims jumped into the street or burned to death. Rose Schneiderman, a Polish-born American feminist, socialist, member of the New York Women's Trade Union League, and a founding member of the American Civil Liberties Union, gave an impassioned speech to thousands of mourners who marched down Fifth Avenue after the shirtwaist fire. This is not the first time girls have been burned alive in this city. Every week I must learn of the untimely deaths of one of my sister workers. Too much blood has been spilled. I know from my experience it is up to working people to save themselves. The only way they can save themselves is by a strong working class movement. And that was Rose Schneiderman. And that is as true a century later as it was then for women and men. And so now we switch screens from Women's History Month to focus another 11 months of male dominance. And who is the dominant male of our national tribe? A narcissistic, bloviating, lying bully with an orange, leonine, fake patch atop his diseased, pathological brain. There is indeed something dreadfully wrong about our theory of unnatural selection. And that was something I wrote. And now I'd like to read something by Nancy Campbell Mead, who is past president of the Central Oregon Coast NOW, National Organization for Women, who lives in Depot Bay. And this was written for the Newport Times, Why We Celebrate Women's History Month. Women's History Month had its beginnings in the first celebration of International Women's Day, March 8, 1911. At that time, there was a worldwide interest in women's issues, especially voting rights. In 1980, President Jimmy Carter proclaimed the first Women's History Week, and in 1987, at the urging of the National Women's History Project, Congress declared the month of March as the first Women's History Month. In the United States, we have celebrated March as Women's History Month ever since. The importance of setting aside a month to recognize women's achievements cannot be overstated. Women's contributions to history have, for the most part, gone unrecognized. Despite their many achievements, very few women have been awarded such prestigious awards as Pulitzer and Nobel Prizes. There are many examples of women doing much of the work, but men receiving the prizes. For example, Lise Meitner discovered and understood nuclear fission, but Otto Hahn took credit and was awarded the Nobel Prize. More recently, we have the example of Dolores Huerta, who established the predecessor organization to the United Farm Workers and was every bit the leader and organizer that Cesar Chavez was. Yet it is Cesar Chavez who we read and hear most about. It is only recently that important female historical figures are starting to become featured in films. Prior to the last few years, it was men who were the heroes, with women shown almost exclusively in, quote, supporting roles. When I was growing up, I had almost no woman role models to look up to in history books. I remember reading about Joan of Arc, who, in hindsight, may have been the first prominent feminist in history. Then there was Betsy Ross, who, legend has it, sewed the first American flag. Yet I learned nothing about the heroism of many women at the time, such as Deborah Sampson. I remember mention of the 19th Amendment being passed in 1919, granting women the right to vote. But I remember nothing being mentioned of the women who fought so valiantly for so many years to see its passage come to fruition, including being beaten, jailed, and force-fed. I remember reading nothing about Frances Perkins, the first woman cabinet member and the person responsible for the Social Security and Fair Labor Standards Acts. Not surprisingly, it was Eleanor Roosevelt who made her husband select Perkins as Secretary of Labor. He did not want her. The importance of Women's History Month is at least twofold. The first, it increases the knowledge and awareness of and honors the many achievements of women that have long gone unrecognized. And the second, it teaches our children that women can and do accomplish remarkable things, that any child, regardless of gender, race, religion, national or sexual orientation, can grow up to make history. By bringing women's achievements to everyone's awareness, more women of all ages, races, and identities are invited to participate and lead. In honor of Women's History Month, all during the month of March, Central Oregon Coast Now has featured women who made history and included them on our Facebook page. This year's theme for Women's History Month has been Visionary Women, Champions of Peace and Nonviolence. And we focused on women who have led in this area. We welcome suggestions of women to honor. And that was Nancy Campbell Meade, who is past president of the Central Oregon Coast Now National Organization for Women. She lives in Depot Bay, and she wrote her article for the Newport News Times, Why We Celebrate Women's History Month. This has been Michael McCusker.